All right, this is October 12th, and we are finishing Lecture 10, and then we'll begin Lecture 11. And to my dismay, I discovered I left all of the outlines for Lecture 11, the one on exploitation, in my printer in my office. So I will bring you your outline next time, but I think the lecture has a fairly straightforward structure so that the outline isn't strictly necessary. So what we were working on Monday was this, a kind of double task, really. It was one to discuss the substance of the question, what is class? How should we think about this particular concept, both in general terms within the full array of uses in sociology, and these particulars of how to think about this concept overall within the Marxian tradition. But I also was using that task as a case in point for illustrating the process of concept formation, how you go about really taking to task a given concept and working hard on it. And in that respect, it was both the problem of how do we provide precise criteria for distinguishing one kind of class concept from another. That was the first part of the lecture. And then I was going through a step-by-step guide to building the concept of class from first premises up to its more complicated form within the Marxian tradition. And we were in the cookbook part of the class, of that discussion. This is under Roman numeral 2 in your outline. And I'll just quickly go through it and get to where we were. So the first step was to really come to terms with this relational versus gradational idea. And I just want to, you know I beat this particular point over the head a lot. It is really a foundational point to understand the relational aspect of class. One signal of the relational aspect of a concept are the labels that are used. So when you have a relational concept of class, the classes that are defined by those relations have names. That's typically true for relations. The way persons are fit into relations get named. So we have husbands and wives, right? The name, the word husband is undefinable outside of its relationship to the name wife. Now, there's no way you can just define a husband by the attributes of that person without invoking something else about a relationship to another. And that's true whether you think of the relation as connecting the persons or their practices, the roles. And that's true for class analysis as well. So the characteristic names for classes in the Marxian tradition are capitalists and workers, lords and serfs, slave owners and slaves. Those are names, and the names are derived from the nature of the relation. And in each case, you can't define one without invoking the other. That's what relational concepts do. Gradational concepts don't have quite that character. You have lower. Well, of course, you can't have lower without having upper, but there's no relationship between lower and upper. It's just a different point on a scale. It's an underlying metric which happens to give you values, but there's no relation that binds together the activities and practices of lower and upper inherently. Now, of course, there may in fact be, but then you have to think about what are those binding together relations. So just, you know, put this in your armory of ideas to continually come back to. Relations. What does this really mean? And the signal of naming is a good hook to kind of get a sense of it. Once you do that, you got to figure out what defines one kind of relation versus another. What distinguishes class relations from gender relations? We'll be discussing much more of that later. Class relations are a specific form of relations of production. The relations of production are to be distinguished from the technical division of labor in production, which just describes the kind of input-output nature of production. The relations of production, or more properly, the social relations of production, define the social relations that bind together the activities of people in a variety of different possible ways. Class relations, then, are a particular type of relation of production when the powers and rights bound up with those relations are unequally distributed. When some people within those relations have a role of telling other people what to do, of controlling the way the means of production are used by other people, of having a capacity to appropriate the fruits of the labor of what's done within production. That's also a relationship, how the social relations of control over the surplus are structured. All of those things define the unequal distributions of, when those capacities are unequally distributed among the participants in a production process, we then have class relations, not simply relations of production. We have class relations. There are relations of production in a worker-owned co-op, but the relations of production within the co-op do not involve the unequal distribution of rights and powers. And that's why we would say that there isn't a class division inside of a worker-owned co-op. There might still be a sense in which the worker-owned co-op is embedded in a set of class relations because the workers in that co-op have rights and powers over their own means of production which exclude access to those means of production of outsiders. And depending upon how the overall structure is of the society in which that worker-owned co-op is embedded, that might lead one to say, yes, the workers in a worker-owned co-op are in a distinctive class relation to work to people outside of the co-op. That's another problem, and it's a hard one to really figure out. But still, within a worker-owned co-op, there is an equal distribution of rights and powers over means of production, and therefore we would say the worker-owned co-op is not an instance of a class-divided organization of production. It's internally classless in that sense. There, it might have status differences. There might be senior, respected, and new members. There could be esteem variations. There could be some ne'er-do-wells and some very responsible people. So there's maybe all sorts of divisions inside of a worker-owned co-op that are endogenous to that form of organization. There may be divisions of labor. You can have technical divisions of labor within worker-owned co-ops. But the principle of a worker-owned co-op is that with respect to the control over the means of production, there is an egalitarian distribution of the rights and powers over the disposition of the means of production and the appropriation of the fruits of labor. All right. That's the second step. The third step, variations in class relations. Well, I've begun that by just invoking the worker-owned co-op. The key idea here is that there are many different kinds of class relations, qualitatively distinct types of class relations. The centerpiece of the large-scale historical variation in types of class relations is the question of what can be owned. What sorts of aspects of assets in production, what aspects of the means of production and the forces of production, what aspects of them are ownable, and how are the and what defines the system of rights by which that ownership is distributed. So here's a very simple case, in some ways the most important. In some class relations, people can be owned. In others, they can't be owned. So in capitalism, people are not ownable. One way of thinking about that is that everyone owns one person themselves, right? So that's one way of expressing this idea. It's in philosophy, it's captured by the expression of self-ownership. People own themselves. There are philosophical problems with that notion. If you own something normally, you're able to sell it, to alienate it. You can't in capitalism. You can't sell yourself. You can sell access to your laboring effort. You know, you can be hired for a wage, but you can't actually sell yourself. We don't allow people to sell themselves into bondage, for example. Ownability of people has been prohibited in capitalism. One way of thinking about feudalism in these terms is to think of feudalism as a social structure of class relations in which the individual peasant is jointly owned by the peasant and the lord. They each have property rights in the peasant. In slavery, the slave owner has absolute property rights in the slave. In feudalism, there's joint ownership of the slave, of the serf. When a peasant in feudalism flees from the land and goes to the city, and the sheriff of Nottingham, as it were, chases after the peasant and brings it back to the land, when we say the peasant is tied to the land, one way of thinking about that is when the peasant has fled to the city, the peasant has actually stolen something from the lord. The peasant has absconded with something that the lord has rights to, namely the labor of the peasant on the land in the form of the fruits of the labor, part of the product of what the laborer produces. So the laborer is not free to flee. On the other hand, the lord in classical feudalism is not free to simply sell the peasant to someone else. In slavery, the peasants can be removed from the land and sent legally, sold and sent somewhere else at the discretion of the owner. That's not true in feudalism. In feudalism, feudal lords are constrained by the nature of the legal system and the traditions and the balance of class forces from simply displacing peasants and moving them somewhere else, giving them to somebody else, selling them to someone else. So slavery is absolute ownership of people. Feudalism is joint ownership of people. And that makes a huge difference. Feudal societies have very different dynamics from slave societies precisely because of the necessity of a different kind of bargaining relationship between the lord and the serf by virtue of this joint ownership of the labor of the serf. So different kinds of class structures vary by the precise nature of the distribution of rights and powers over different kinds of inputs into production. The Cohen framework gives very broad distinctions, but we can imagine all sorts of other gradations. Some people want to argue that the term capitalism is actually too general a term for the heterogeneous systems of class relations that we observe in the modern market-based societies. So these are all market economies. But a market economy in which workers sit on boards of directors of corporations, in which they have rights to part of the profits produced, and all sorts of other devices, should not really be simply amalgamated to some generic capitalism, any more than we want to amalgamate feudalism into some generic slavery. Now, that's what Cohen does, remember. Cohen amalgamates all these varieties into what he calls pre-capitalist class societies. He amalgamates slavery and feudalism into a singular era. In that terms, we could amalgamate everything into capitalism, but there may be distinctions among this amalgamated capitalism that are as big as the distinction between slavery and feudalism. The difference between a robust social democracy and a freewheeling laissez-faire capitalism may be as big a distinction as between feudalism and slavery, in the sense that the actual rights and powers of people within the relations of production are distributed in very different kinds of ways. So that's just an issue that you have to think about in this third step, the nature of the variations of class relations. So we start with relations, we talk about class relations as opposed to other kinds of relations, we go to then variations within all possible class relations. The next step is to talk about class locations within class relations, or what I just refer to as locations within class relations. this is a way of describing the places in this structure of relations that are actually occupied by people. The simplest kind of mapping of the locations within a class structure sees these locations as polarized, simple polarization. There are two categories within every relation. Now that's the kind of paradigm of a social relation. The simplest form of social relation that we can think of has this binary character. And lots of the ideas we have about social relations have this binary character. Families are a good case. There are husbands and wives, and in a monogamous kind of family structure and marriage structure, there's a kind of simple relation there. For every husband, there's a wife. For every wife, there's a husband. There's a simple binary relation. There's two people bound together through relations. And that's one way to think about class structures at a very level of abstraction, that every kind of class relation has a binary set of locations that are associated with it. Marx, in various places, has elegant passages that evoke that slave master and slave, lord and serf, capitalist and worker. Those are all the binary relations. As we'll see when we look at the problem of the middle class and the class structure of capitalism, that's not a very satisfactory way of thinking about class relations in actual concrete capitalist societies, and that's why I, in various ways, have tried to grapple with this problem of complexity. The core of the intuition around complexity is that some actual locations that people fill are simultaneously located in more than one class. That is, they're bound together to other people through more than one homogeneous, one-dimensional relationship. And we'll figure out what that could possibly mean when we discuss that problem next week. Okay, we have variations in class relations. We worry about the locations, how to situate individual persons within those relations. Step five is to understand that class relations and the concept of class operates at both the macro and the micro level. Now, talk about a distinction that has a lot of play in sociology, and you encounter time and time again. There's this problem of the relationship between the micro and the macro, micro and macro. What do we mean by micro and macro? For class analysis, the way I like to think of it is that the macro concept of class refers to class structures, which is the totality of all class relations within some unit of analysis. So you can talk about the class structure of a firm. You could talk about the class structure of a country, the class structure of a city. You could even talk about the class structure of the world as a whole. So the idea of a macro concept is pick some unit of analysis and analyze the totality of class relations within that unit, and you have then described the macro class structure of that unit of analysis. There is no natural unit for that problem. There are some units that are privileged with respect to some problems. So if you're discussing the way in which class relations shape the politics of nation states, the class structure of the nation state is the privileged unit of analysis for understanding that. If you look more deeply, you may decide, no, that's not true. The actual politics of the nation state and the struggles around it really depend upon the quite distinct class structure of different regions. So certainly before the Civil War in the U.S., it would be misleading to say that American politics is dictated by the national class structure. That's all you really need to study. No, it was clear that there were two very different class structures in the U.S., articulated, they connected, they weren't two different worlds that had nothing to do with each other, they were deeply bound together. But the nature of the politics was at least in part generated by the independent effects of these two different class structures on their regional politics, which then affected the national politics. So you have to think about the relevant unit of analysis and specify the totality of class relations within that relevant unit of analysis. That's the macro problem. The micro problem is to focus on the impact on the lives of a person living within these relations. So the micro problem is, how do these class structures impact on the lives of persons? And I like to think of the most micro level is the real flesh and blood individual persons that are living their lives within class relations. The micro-macro distinction is not actually itself a binary. It's a tiered level of micro to macro. We will discuss this more when we look at the problem of class consciousness and class formation. But just to give you the first way of thinking about that, the most micro level of analysis in sociology is the social relations between individual persons. The lived experience of the person, him or herself, that is the individual persons within those relations, is actually a bridging object of investigation. It's really social psychology, right? Social psychology is the study of the lives and experiences of individual persons. The micro level of sociology is the study of the interrelationships among individual persons at the micro level. Interpersonal relations is the most micro aspect of sociology. The study of an individual separate person is not actually an object of study in sociology per se. It's the object of study in social psychology, the interface between the social and the psychological processes. But it's really relational all the way down, because if you really think about what do you study when you study the psychological aspects of a person, you're studying the interrelations among all the relational aspects interior to a person in their consciousness, in their mind, and their emotional and psychological makeup. And then social psychology is the connection between relations within persons and the relations between persons. So one way of thinking about this hierarchy of relations is the micro level of sociology is the relation between persons. The study of organizations is the study of the relations between the relations between persons, when those are bounded in a particular way. So organizational analysis is an analysis of the relations among relations. The study of economic markets is the study of the relations among the relations among relations. That is, the relations among firms. Firms are relations among persons. The relations among the relations among persons. A market is the relation among firms. So each level, you're adding a relation among the lower level units of analysis, which are themselves consistent and analyzed in terms of relations. So it's, as they say, relations all the way down. You know, when you get down to the molecular level, what is it that you're studying? You're studying the relations among atoms. When you get inside of the atom, you're studying the relations among particles. You know, when you get into the particles themselves, you're studying the relations among whatever these weird things that go on inside of particles are. It's relations all the way down. That's what you really study, is the relations all the way down. The micro level of class analysis is looking at the impact on the lives of persons within the relations of production, how this affects their lives and their own interactions. And there are two primary mechanisms or processes through which the micro level of analysis is explored. One is in terms of experiences, lived experiences of person within these relations. And the other is in terms of interests. Interests and experiences are the two key micro-level class analysis terms to identify the kinds of mechanisms which are in play. Experiences refers to things that happen to you because you are in a class location. Things happen to you by virtue of being in a class. You have certain experiences, the experience of looking for a job, the experience of being told what to do, the experience of losing your job and high anxiety over having to cope with the insecurity, or the experience of bossing people around and getting flack from your own superiors, the experience of having to worry about your financial investments under conditions of market turbulence. These are the experiences that capitalists have under current conditions. So there are experiences people have, but there are also interests that people have. Experiences refer to things that happen to you by virtue of your class relation. Interest refers to what you have to do to meet your needs because of your class position. Interests refer to things you have to do. Experiences refer to things that happen to you. Interests, in a sense, always have a future orientation. Your interests always refer to what you have to do to get what you want. And what you have to do means what you have to do now to get what you want later. It can be tonight, tomorrow, doesn't matter. But interests are really always, in that sense, future-looking, whereas experiences are, in a sense, backwards-looking. Experiences are the total trajectory of things that have happened to you. Interests are the things you have to do given your situation. Interests are a way of talking about strategies, the goals of strategies, that are imposed on you by virtue of your situation. You may or may not act on those interests, of course. You may not even be aware of them fully, but they are the things that are imposed on you by virtue of your circumstances, centered around your actions, whereas experiences are centered around things that happen to you. We'll be looking at that contrast, particularly when we get to the ideology and consciousness part of the course, because that's the site where this kind of bears on this micro level of the analysis. Okay, that's micro and macro levels of class analysis. Step 6, the explanatory claims. These are what I would call the fundamental theses of class analysis. I tried to kind of distill these into little memorable formula, as it were. The first is, what you have determines what you get. That's a kind of simple idea in class analysis. What you have determines what you get. The assets that you control and own determines what you get as a flow. Your assets determine your flow. The second is, what you have determines what you have to do to get what you get. That's the central argument for why workers dispossessed of the means of production have to go look for work in order to get income, and why capitalists who own the means of production have to go and look for workers in order to generate a surplus out of which they acquire their income. What you have determines what you get. What you have determines what you have to do to get what you get. And the third thesis is, what you have to do to get what you get determines whose interests are opposed to your interests. That is, in a class analysis, what you have to do to get what you get puts you into conflict with others. It doesn't just define a set of activities. So Robinson Crusoe, on an island, is faced with the problem of what he has to do to get what he gets. He has to figure out how to survive in that environment by creating a production process which he can manage himself in order to generate food, especially. Once Friday appears, the other person on the island, he then has another option. What he has to do to get what he gets involves telling Friday to do things for him. And suddenly, there's a social relationship in which there are two actors, each of which faces the problem, what they have to do to get what they get, and in this case, their strategies, what they have to do to get what they get, puts their interests in conflict rather than in unison. Actually, I don't remember the Robinson Crusoe story well enough to know the extent to which Friday and Robinson Crusoe are collaboratively cooperating, or Robinson Crusoe is actually, in effect, employing Friday in this story. Okay, that's step 6. The Marxist class analysis then adds to all this. All of these things up to step six don't necessarily imply a Marxian analysis. We've excluded some kinds of class analyses by step six, but by step six, you already have Weberian class analysis. Weberian class analysis, there are variations in class analysis. There are micro and macro settings for the study of class. And there are these three explanatory claims. That is, Weber also recognizes that what you have to do to get what you get puts you into conflict with others. Conflicts within the market he's particularly attuned to. So you get through class step six, you don't yet have a distinctively Marxian analysis. Step seven is what defines this stream of steps as Marxist, which gives it a Marxian specificity. And that's the identification of the specific mechanisms involved in what you have to do to get what you get determines whose interests are opposed to your interests. The elaboration of the actual mechanisms involved with that last claim is what gives specificity to the Marxian analysis. And there are two primary mechanisms in the Marxian, yeah. Okay, so the step seven is an identification of the mechanisms involved in the third bullet point under step six. The third bullet point in step six just says that the activities people engage in to get what they get puts them in conflict with others. That is, there are interests in play that are opposed to each other as everybody does what they have to do to get what they get. What are the mechanisms that bring those interests into conflict? The Marxian class analysis says there are two mechanisms. One is identified with the term exploitation. That's what we'll be talking about in a moment. It's a way of talking about how the interests of people within class relations are antagonistic. And the second is domination. It's a way of talking about how the activities of people are controlled by others as they do what they have to do to get what they get. Domination is a description of the power relations over the activities. Exploitation is a description of the antagonism of the interests generated through those interactions. We'll be explicating exploitation in the rest of this lecture, so I won't go further with that here. I'm going to skip Roman numeral 3 in the outline. I think that's been elaborated, and we've talked about that in other contexts, and we'll be certainly getting back to that when we discuss exploitation. The role of class as a critical concept, not just a descriptive or explanatory concept. And certainly that's a hallmark of the Marxian use of class. Class analysis is a way of organizing a critique of existing structures, not just an explanation of how things work. Finally, I'd just like to mention this full repertoire. A lot of what we'll be doing at different times in the semester is discussing this menu. This has to do with the use of class as an adjective rather than a noun. Now, it turns out, I think, that a lot of trouble occurs when people use class as a noun rather than as an adjective. I think it's best deployed most rigorously when it's an adjective. Thus, to talk about class locations rather than the working class or class organizations. So when people say, you know, the capitalist class refuses to make concessions to workers in the neoliberal era, right, or, you know, some of these kinds of grand claims. That is, they use an agency verb and append it to class as a noun. That's an elliptical statement. It's a shorthand for something like the organizations representing the interests of capitalists, capitalist persons, or capitalist class formations or working class parties. That is, I think it's better to use, it's clearer what you're talking about when you use class as an adjective. And this is particularly relevant to the class location, class structure problem. Sometimes in my work, I've been asked the question, how many classes are there? And people have said that, you know, Eric Wright has a framework of class analysis where he says there are 12 classes. Ha, 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 isn't that ridiculous? There are 12 classes. I don't actually have a model with 12 classes. I have a model of class relations which generate an array of locations within class structures. Some of these locations I refer to as class locations. Others are contradictory class locations. But it's an arbitrary set of distinctions among how many locations. That just depends upon how fine-grained the analysis you want to do is. At an abstract level of analysis, I analyze capitalism as having two kinds of class locations, capitalists and workers. At a very fine-grained analysis, if I'm trying to look at very detailed questions of income determination or class consciousness, I will differentiate amongst a much wider array of locations within class relations. But those locations then get collectively organized into many much smaller groupings of organizations that represent class interests. So you don't have 12 or 8 or 64 classes. You end up with class associations of various sorts that represent the interests of broad coalitions of people who are located in this very differentiated structure. So all of that is clarified, I think, by using the expression class location to describe how individuals are situated, class structure to define how the overall structure is organized, and more generally using class as an adjective. So here on this list there are 7 repertoires. I don't know why class location got left off of that list. That certainly should be part of it. Class structures, class formation, class location, class interests, class formations. I use the term class formation to describe the formation of collective organizations representing people in class locations around their class interests. So class formations represent people in class locations around their class interests. Class capacities refers to the power and capacity for action of individuals by virtue of their class location, and class formations by virtue of the social relations formed within the collective organizations that represent those individuals. Class practices refer to the activities of people and organizations by virtue of their class locations or their collective organization. Class struggles refer to the confrontation of class practices. Class practices is just a description of activities. Class struggles are an expression of a way of talking about the conflictual interconnections of those activities. And class consciousness refers to the beliefs and attitudes, preferences, ideas of people around class relations, class interests, and so on. All of these concepts will be worked on throughout the semester. All right, that's the kind of introductory gambit around the concept of class in general, how to locate it with respect to the array of possible class concepts, and how to build up the specificity of a Marxian concept, starting with the most elementary foundations. Any follow-up issues that anyone would like to raise around this? Yeah. Oh, you're just scratching your... Okay. When a professor asks, do you have any questions, and then you scratch your neck, then you're...
I'm sick. So, actually, I have a question. Can you talk a little bit more about variations in class relations? So, it seems like... the way I always understood is that you can define a class relation by office formation. If labor has access to music production, but is exploited by a lower than that's feudal structure. So if that's the case, then wouldn't you be able to define any, all these different variants of capitalism, wouldn't they still be defined by whether or not workers have to sell their labor?
Well, one could. That, and you know, that would be one approach, and say that these are all just subtypes. But the subtypes could still be as different from each other as slavery is from feudalism.
But how? If the relationship of labor to the means of production is still the same?
Well, because workers can have, for example, in some capitalist systems, workers have actual rights to their jobs. So it's very hard for capitalists, if not impossible, to fire them, unless the firm goes bankrupt.
They still have to sell their labor to the capital.
Well, except they, arguably, if they have a right to their job, if they actually cannot be fired, they have a property right in their job, they do have access to the means of production. They just can't sell it to someone else. So they have partial access. They have some of the rights of ownership. That is, they can't be fired from using those means of production.
That's, they can't sit at home either. I mean, they have
well,
to.
But the capital, you know, they can't sit at home. That's why it's not socialism. Well, of course, in socialism they can't sit at home either. You know, it's not the case in socialism, everybody. So it's not quite sufficient to say that as an individual person, it's capitalist so long as you can't sit at home. Yeah.
But isn't there, in his case, isn't there still exploitation? Isn't there still domination?
Sure. So it's a, just as in feudalism and slavery, in both of them there's coercive extraction. In both feudalism and in slavery, there's the direct use of coercion to extract surplus. And there, that's the justification by which Cohen says they are all pre-capitalist class relations. And yet, we know that feudalism and slavery have very different kinds of dynamics. In feudalism, the peasants have direct control over significant resources. They control the means of production directly. They cannot just be dislodged by the feudal lord without it being a violation of those class relations and provoking huge amounts of conflict. In some feudal systems, that's extremely stable. The lords literally don't have the capacity. If they tried to displace peasants, they would be undermining their own conditions of existence. Other feudalisms are much weaker, and then feudal serfdom gradually becomes much more like slavery. So in Russia, by the 18th century, serfs were basically slaves. Whole serf populations could be sold to another landlord. So they were essentially slaves, and that's how people began to talk about it, that they were slaves. So in feudalism, serfdom and slavery shade into each other. In capitalism, one could argue in this big family of phenomena that are market-based economies in which surplus is extracted economically rather than through direct coercion, there still are significant variations in the actual distributions of rights and powers over means of production in ways that really does change the character of the class relation. So the class relations in the era when in Europe and in Japan, where capitalists could not fire workers, they were really, and sometimes even by law, you know, in the procedures by which you had to go through to fire a worker in the highly protected labor contract systems, just were essentially the equivalent that you can't fire a professor from University of Wisconsin. I mean, I have complete job security. It's not that there couldn't be some circumstance in which I could lose my job, but the main circumstance in which I can lose my job is if I violate the law in certain ways. You know, if I misbehave dramatically. You know, stealing from the university, sexual abuse. I mean, there are things that I can do that will get me fired. But I can't be fired without cause unless the university goes bankrupt. You know, there is the fine print if the university dissolves. All right, so I'm in this incredibly privileged position, a privileged position that very few wage earners in the United States hold. But there were capitalist systems in which a fairly significant part, a third of the labor force in Japan, had that level of protection of their jobs. It's pretty, you know, you get hired at age 18 in Toyota and you retire at age 65, knowing at 18 that you're going to be there till you're 65. That's a pretty incredible labor contract. To me, a good case can be made that that is more than, that's a deep enough variation in the actual distribution of rights and powers over the means of production to mean that to just call it a variant of capitalism is really, it is. I call Japan a capitalist economy even in the period when it had those rights. But it's somewhat misleading. It overly minimizes the character of that difference. And it adds a layer of complexity to our analysis. You know, once at the level of abstraction where a lot of the things we want to explain occur, that's where these variations matter. Any other questions about this? These kinds of issues are, I know a number of you are interested in issues around the informal economy. Garrett, where wrote his papers. Well, somebody, yeah, you wrote your paper. Did you write your paper? Steve, you wrote your paper. Yeah. I've been reading a few of them on the informal economy, right? I mean, the informal economy is really interesting in this respect because it contains a hugely heterogeneous set of relations of production and distributions of rights and powers, and it's really an interesting task to kind of sort it all out and to see how different kinds of informality may mean completely different sorts of things, that it isn't actually a phenomenon. It's a heterogeneous matrix of phenomena, and that some of them may be prefigurative of quite distinct post-capitalist relations of production, and other of them are vestiges of pre-capitalist relations, and others are adaptations to total marginalization from capitalism. There's a whole series of different kinds of informality which really shouldn't be amalgamated as if they were all one kind of class situation. Any other issues on this very general introduction? All right. The next topic is, I think, one of the coolest. You don't have an outline. I am sorry. I think this is just one of the most interesting concepts that we're going to encounter all semester, the concept of exploitation. It has way more potent sociological meaning than is usually considered. It's not just a bit of radical polemic to incite moral passion about a particular form of oppression, although it is that. It's not an innocent term. You know, nobody is going to use the term exploitation in which they are using it as a way of expressing the moral worth of a relation. Exploitation is a way of indicting a relation. But what I'd like us to do is not mainly focus on the moral indictment aspect of it, but to really look at what is explanatory about this concept and why it identifies a particular kind of explanatory problem and a particular kind of explanatory mechanism that has implications far beyond simply Marxian class analysis, and why this is a sociologically rich idea. The sociologically rich part of this concept also is the aspect that depends least upon the labor theory of value. So there is this issue about how the labor theory of value is a way of talking about exploitation. And then the additional question, how much does the concept depend upon the validity of the labor theory of value? So if you reject the labor theory of value, you have to drop the concept of capitalist exploitation. I think the explanatory part of exploitation, the part of it that's most sociologically interesting, does not depend upon the labor theory of value. The labor theory of value is one way of explicating the concept of exploitation in a certain kind of quantitative way. But it isn't the core of the concept. And that furthermore, the core of the concept enables you to explore all sorts of non-class phenomena and see ways in which exploitation occurs outside of the arena of class analysis. So that we can talk about sexual exploitation or cultural exploitation in a meaningful way. Not just as a bit of rhetoric, but as a precise way of identifying a distinctive kind of context of interdependency, which is exploitative and not merely nasty. So exploitation is not just a powerful way of talking about nastiness, it's a specific way of talking about a particular form of interdependence within which nastiness occurs, as it were. And that's what I want to really bring home today. Maybe the thing for us to do is actually take our break slightly earlier so that we get the whole exploitation story without an interruption. So in the vain hope of having as much time as possible for this, let's reconvene as close to 5 after as we can manage, okay? All right, so now let's jump into the problem of exploitation. What I would like to do as a very briefly, I don't want to, in the lecture notes which are going to be posted, there is an extremely detailed set of notes that goes on and on and on and on. It goes on my lecture notes from page 2 to page 12. Now that's because originally this was an entire lecture. I devoted a whole lecture to the labor theory of value formulation of the problem of exploitation. Kind of a really careful, detailed account of all the ins and outs of how to think about it within that framework. That's the bit that I'm going to short circuit here. But the notes, I think, will be helpful if you want to just read through those 10 pages of notes. It gives you a step-by-step account of all the components of the labor theory of value.
Does it also tell why it's not considered?
I don't believe in these notes I present the critique of the labor theory of value here. No, this was meant to be just straightforward exposition of how, if you're going to think of it this way. But let me discipline myself to just go through this, be done with this by 11:15. So we'll do 7 or 8 minutes on the labor theory of value. The basic idea of the labor theory of value, as I think I briefly explained earlier, was the basic intuition is that things have a value which enables different quantities to exchange with each other, and that what prices do is provide us with the practical metric for measuring their value. Now, prices, of course, will vary a lot. If something's in short supply, its price will go up. If it's in abundant supply, the price will go down. If you produce too much of something, its price may actually fall below its value. Now, in our ordinary language, this all makes sense. Everybody has a notion that if a store is going bankrupt and they're having to sell their stuff, you're getting a commodity, a television set, at a price way below what it's really worth. What it's really worth. The notion of what it's really worth means that you think there is some sort of value in the thing, independent of what the price happens to be. God, I got a bargain. God, for half price, meaning half what I think it's actually worth. The notion of value is meant to explain what the equilibrium exchange rates would be. Once you abstract from all the oversupply, undersupply, supply and demand stuff, why is it that the supply and demand over all these different things tends to settle down to a kind of stable set of exchange rates between different commodities? It must be because it has some kind of inherent value. Labor time was the metric that was used. Now, it's not just labor time. That's a little too crude. Because, after all, there's lots of different kinds of labor. There's skilled labor, there's unskilled labor, there's the labor of shoemaking and the labor of orange picking. You know, it's not the concrete labor, the concrete activity that's in play here. It's what's called abstract labor, this abstract property of being the result of human activity. Furthermore, the value of a commodity is even not quite abstract labor. Just think of it this way. Let's think in the really simple case, artisanal production. It makes it simpler, less worry about it. You have two people making a standard chair, two shops, and the chairs of this sort exchange on the market for a particular price. But one of them is just lazy and slow and takes twice as long to produce the chair as everybody else. Now, we wouldn't want to say that chair has twice as much value just because it takes twice as long to produce it. If the reason it takes twice as long to produce is not because it has all sorts of refinements that makes it actually a different commodity, but just because the person works slower. Well, that means that the actual labor value of a commodity isn't its actual labor time it takes. It's what's called the socially necessary labor time to produce it. Where that expression, socially necessary labor time, means, on average, given the way the market works and given the level of technology, how much labor does it take to produce this thing? It's, again, a kind of average equilibrium sort of notion. One of the things that this means is that if you are very clever and you suddenly figure out a way to produce the chair in half the time of everybody else, before everybody else does, your chair is still going to exchange at the socially necessary labor time, but it costs you half as much labor to produce. So you're going to make a huge profit on that chair. For you, the price of that chair is way above the value of what you've contributed, but that's because your innovation has enabled you to reduce the amount of labor time. Once everybody else adopts your technology and the new socially necessary labor time declines, then those super profits disappear. The prices will readjust to value. Okay, that's the labor theory of value story. Now, where does exploitation come from? It's a really nifty idea that Marx came up with. Here's the basic story. Labor power is our capacity to work. That's what workers sell on the labor market. Workers don't sell themselves. They don't sell their actual effort. What they sell is their capacity to work. And what they get paid for their capacity to work is the value of their labor power. It's just like any other commodity. You get paid the value of your commodity. Well, the value of a chair is the amount of labor time it takes to produce a chair. So what's the value of labor power? It's the amount of labor time it takes to produce labor power. So how do we think about the amount of time it takes to produce labor power? Well, it's all the things that it takes to keep a person alive and fit. Basically, your consumption basket. Abstracting from families, from children, from all that stuff, all those are complications. Just talking about the individual. It takes a certain amount of bread, clothing, and shelter. That's the kind of iconic trilogy, bread meaning food, shelter, and clothing to survive and to reproduce your labor power, to produce and reproduce it. How do workers get their bread, shelter, and clothing? Well, they get a wage. The wage that they get is sufficient to cover their costs of reproduction because that's the value of their labor power. So let's say you hire somebody to work for 8 hours a day, and the value of all the things it takes to keep that person alive is the equivalent of 4 hours a day. It takes 4 hours of labor time to produce the necessary means of subsistence of the worker. But the employer tells the worker, I'm not going to hire you for 4 hours of labor and pay you that wage. I'm going to hire you for 8 hours of effort and pay you a wage sufficient to reproduce you. But hidden in that wage is 4 hours of labor. The capitalist gets the benefit of 8 hours of effort, of laboring time, 8 hours of value being added to new products, but only pays the worker for 4 hours. The difference between those two is called surplus value. Worker works for 8 hours. The bundle of commodities consumed by the workers is only 4 hours. And the difference then is surplus value. Surplus value then is the measure of how much additional value is produced by the laboring effort of person beyond what is needed to cover the cost of producing that the commodity labor power. What Marx then argued, unlike other classical economists, is that we have to distinguish labor power from labor. The word labor refers to the actual laboring activity. And that difference is surplus value. And the ratio between the two, surplus value over the value of labor power, that ratio is the rate of exploitation. Now, once you get those ideas straight, surplus is the amount of labor value generated beyond what's needed to reproduce the worker, you can see there are two different ways that you could increase the amount of exploitation. One way is you can lengthen the length of the working day. So let's suppose it takes, given the existing technology, it takes 4 hours of laboring activity to produce all the goods and services that a worker needs to survive, and you can force them to work 12 hours a day, then you get 8 hours of surplus and 4 hours of what's called necessary labor, the labor needed to produce the laborer. If you can lengthen the working day, you can increase exploitation. Equivalently, if you can force down the standards of living of workers, if you can actually reduce how much they need to consume because they were consuming too much from point of view of capital, you can also increase the ratio between the surplus and variable capital. Right? So those mechanisms Marx referred to as absolute exploitation or absolute surplus value, increasing the ratio between the surplus and the value of labor power by lengthening the working day or by pushing down consumption. But there's another way you could increase exploitation, and that's by improving the productivity of the means of consumption of workers. So if under 19th century technology it takes 4 hours to produce all the food that workers consume, and under 21st century technologies it takes 1 hour, then you've increased the exploitation of workers without at all affecting their standard of living. But you've gained 3 hours of surplus because it just takes a lot less time to produce the material conditions of life of workers. That fact, the fact that you can increase exploitation by increasing productivity and therefore producing the means of existence of workers more efficiently, that fact is what enables the real standards of living in ordinary material sense, how much people consume, to increase, and for exploitation to either remain the same or increase as well. It's also why you can't simply say, aha, workers in Guatemala are more exploited than workers in the United States by looking at how much poorer they are, because they're also using much less productive means of production. It's possible, although it's not necessarily true, but it's possible that workers in developed capitalist countries are more exploited than workers in poor countries, even though they live much better, because they're living in an economy that is so vastly more productive. So if the economy is 10 times more productive and they're living twice as well, then they're probably more exploited. So it's difficult to go from the observed standards of living of people, how many calories they consume, how comfortable are they, how big are their televisions, to how exploited they are is not a simple equation. It's not a simple matter, because the level of your exploitation depends upon the productivity of the means of production you're using, since the productivity of those means of production determines what the cost of reproducing labor power is. All right, so that's the basic model for the Marxian, classical Marxian way of talking about exploitation. The way in which the principle of exploitation was demonstrated was by introducing the labor power labor distinction and showing that workers are forced to work more hours, producing more value than is embodied in their in the commodities which they consume with their wages. And the labor theory of value then becomes the metric by which this occurs. Now, there are lots of objections to the labor theory of value that have been raised. I've mentioned some briefly, and I don't think we need to go through that. The question, though, that is of importance is the sociologically interesting aspect of the labor of exploitation and its relevance for class analysis dependent upon the labor theory of value. So I want to propose a way of thinking about exploitation which doesn't invoke the labor theory of value at all, although the labor theory of value can still be a perfectly good way of measuring it. So if we think of exploitation as an independent idea and then ask the question, how could we measure it? The labor theory of value could be a measure of it, even if it is not the case that labor values are what determine prices and profits. Right? So even if there's not a causal connection between abstract labor embodied in commodities and their price ratios, even if that's not true, labor values could be a way of measuring a concept that we care about, but whose foundations don't depend upon it. And that's the argument I want to make here. So now we're going to move on to what in the notes, when you eventually see them, will be Roman numeral 3, a rethinking exploitation. The way in which I introduce this in Class Clowns is via the story of the shmoo, which I hope, if you haven't had a chance to read the chapter, I hope you will. Sometimes when I give this kind of lecture as an invited lecture out in the world, you know, I get asked sometimes to come and give a talk on class. I project on a screen the story of the shmoo and act it out. I do a full-scale performance of the story of the shmoo. When I've given this talk in Latin America, which I've been invited to do on a number of occasions, I've translated the shmoo story into Spanish, but I still tell it in English rendition. I won't do that here. It's entertaining, but it doesn't add to the depth of our grappling with the ideas, and I'd rather focus on that. The purpose of the story of the shmoo is to tell a story about social relations between actors that interact with different kinds of assets and are engaged in an economic structure of interdependencies in ways that generate particular kinds of conflict. And to try to extract from that parable, then, what the underlying mechanisms in play are. What are the stakes in these conflicts? At its core is a distinction between what I have come to call simple oppression and exploitation. That ends up really being the pivotal issue in explicating this whole argument. My definition of material exploitation, of simple exploitation, is the following. Oppression. Economic oppression occurs, when the material welfare of A is causally at the expense of B. If the well-being, if the material welfare of one person or group is causally dependent on the deprivations of another, That is material oppression. Note that this is a critical concept. It implies the existence of an alternative in which B's welfare would be improved when A doesn't oppress B, right? So to say my material well-being causally depends upon your deprivations is to also say that your deprivations would be less if I wasn't benefiting from them. So it says that there's a causal interconnection between my well-being and your deprivations. That's the heart of that notion of oppression. Now, the core of the argument around exploitation is that not all forms of oppression are also exploitation. Exploitation, then, is a subtype of oppression. We can therefore talk about non-exploitative oppression and exploitative oppression. What I tend to do is, for a shorthand, when I use the word oppression without an adjective, I mean non-exploitative oppression. All forms of exploitation are exploitative. I mean, all forms of exploitation are oppressive. Of course, all forms of exploitation are exploitative. But all forms of exploitation are oppressive, but not all forms of oppression are exploitative. Let me give some simple examples to capture this difference, and then try to give a more systematic theoretical description of the contrast. But here's just some examples of both empirical, historical examples. So let's consider the question of peasantry and the land in early modern Europe, in the time of the enclosure movement. So in the early modern period, in many rural context, there was part of the land that was referred to as the commons, which everyone who was a legitimate resident of the area had the right to graze their animals on the commons with various kinds of restrictions and rules. Nevertheless, peasants had the right to graze sheep and cattle on the commons. The commons were therefore a source of income, of standards of living for the peasantry. In the enclosure movement, the commons were fenced off. Peasants were excluded from access to the land. And the land was taken over by gentry, landlords, whatever, and used for their own income-generating purposes. Now, that act of exclusion of peasants from the land is a clear case of economic oppression. The material welfare of the landlord is at the expense of the deprivation. There's a causal connection. The subsequent suffering of the peasants is the result of the appropriation of those resources, which is the source of advantage for the landlord, for the gentry. So that clearly satisfies the economic oppression criterion. If some of those peasants are brought back onto the land as to be on the formerly common land, to be the shepherds or to be the tenant farmers, if the commons is turned into, is plowed under and turned into land for crops, the peasants that are brought back onto the land as wage laborers are exploited. The peasants that are simply excluded from the land are oppressed but not exploited. So exploitation adds to the causal interdependence. My welfare is causally dependent on your deprivations. It adds to that by saying, and in addition to that, I am benefiting from the labor effort you expend using my means of production. My ability to appropriate your labor effort, in addition to my ability to exclude you from access to those means of production, is what defines, in addition to just economic oppression, exploitation. The excluded peasant is not exploited. The peasant who is brought back onto the land as a wage laborer is. Another historical example, compare the fate of indigenous people in North America with indigenous people, let's say, in parts of South Africa. So in North America, there happens to have been indigenous people living in North America before white settlers arrived. The key resource that matters for livelihood in the period is land. There was a conflict between European settlers and the indigenous population over the control of land, in which the European settlers won by pushing the native populations off of the land. Right? Mostly those native populations were not brought back onto the land as slaves or tenant farmers. Efforts at enslaving Native Americans were largely a failure. It turned out to be very difficult to sustain the slave relation of indigenous people who could more easily escape into the hinterland. As a result of that, I think, at least as a rough approximation, we can say that Native Americans were economically oppressed by white settlers, but not exploited. The result of that is the folk saying in 19th century United States, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Right? Now that's, of course, a morally reprehensible slogan. It was a common expression in the United States. Apparently it was an expression introduced by an army colonel who was an Irish immigrant who became part of the Western Army, you know, in the Indian Wars. And made the comment, the only good Indian is a dead Indian, and somehow it got into the press and into popular culture. That's an expression which, however morally abhorrent it is, we all understand what it means and why somebody might say that in 19th century United States. It's comprehensible, and it even has a rationality to it. I don't mean justification. I just mean it's not irrational to make the claim. It would be irrational to make the claim the only good slave is a dead slave, or the only good worker is a dead worker. I mean, that would be just an idiotic statement. You could say the only good slave is a docile slave, or the only good worker is an obedient worker. But you would never have an expression, the only good worker is a dead worker. And the reason is that the capitalist class would suffer if all the workers died. If all the workers disappeared, the capitalists, so to speak, would have to go on the shop floor and set the means of production in motion themselves. The fact that the only good Indian is a dead Indian, the only good worker is an obedient worker, captures the distinction between non-exploitative oppression and exploitation. Joan Robinson, who is a well-known British political economist of the 30s and 40s, I think she lived until the 50s, she once made the quip, the one thing worse than being exploited in capitalism is not being exploited in capitalism. And this is what she meant. She didn't mean it's worse to be a worker than a capitalist. What she meant is it's worse to be unemployed than employed. And to be unemployed is to be not exploited, and to be employed is to be exploited in capitalism. Here's another example. This one is a little more awkward in a way. Consider the relationship between unionization and unemployed workers. If union rules, which raise the wages of union members and create strong union controls, really, so we have a really strong union movement that creates strong union controls over access to jobs. So the union basically controls the hiring practices and excludes people from jobs, thus increasing unemployment. How do we want to think about the relationship between unionized workers and the unemployed? How do we want to think about that? Well, one view is that unionized workers are in a relationship of economic oppression to the unemployed because they are benefiting from an exclusionary set of processes that raise their wages and their job security above what it would be in the absence of unionization, given that it's a capitalist economy. So it's not that given as an alternative to some whole other system they're economically oppressing, but given that they're in a capitalist economy, there is a relation of economic oppression between unionized workers and the unemployed, but not exploitation. Unionized workers don't exploit the unemployed, but they do oppress them. This is one of the reasons why principled union movements seek the state to provide remedies for unemployment. The social democracy is a solution to that problem. Unionized workers can say, because we are prepared to pay higher taxes and support a strong affirmative state that's going to create jobs programs and provide state employment and welfare benefits, we are no longer benefiting from the exclusion of the unemployed from jobs, because we're prepared to pay the cost to neutralize that oppressive effect. I think that's perfectly right, that union movements, which become highly politicized and strongly support an affirmative state that neutralizes the consequences of their exclusionary practices, can, with justification, say, no, we are not oppressing the unemployed. We're doing what is necessary under the constraints of capitalism to expand the opportunities for security and well-being for everyone. But basing that on our power and capacity as strongly solidaristic labor movement. A union movement, on the other hand, which becomes entirely oriented towards the protection of the jobs of the workers in that union, that becomes exclusionary and kind of corporatist in that way, and not deeply political, I think can be indicted for participating in a system of exclusionary economic relations that is oppressive to those who are marginalized. And some people have argued that one of the problems that happened in the American labor movement is that once they were initially a political labor movement that was heavily engaged in fashioning a system-wide class compromise that would have all of these positive effects, increasingly in the course of the 60s and 70s, as perhaps as their circumstances eroded and they became more vulnerable, but perhaps as a more self-interested, narrower kind of practice, they became less committed to system-wide egalitarianism and more committed to job protection for their members. And therefore, they were engaged in practices that had much more this character of economic oppression with respect to those who were marginalized. Yeah?
Oh, I was just going to insert.
Yeah, and that could be
backlash.
Sure. So part of this in the American context was probably fueled by racism and the way racial inequalities intersected labor market inequalities. So that may be part of the explanation for this. But that may be still only part of the explanation. It may have to do with the particular capacity of the strongest sectors of American capitalism to forge an exclusionary deal with their workers and give them sufficient benefits from that exclusionary deal that they're in exchange for depoliticization. You know, so the kind of deal was, we'll give you this really sweet deal, but you gotta pull back from these political fights. And workers were seduced into it because there was a big advantage. You know, that's also part of the story, at least some people would argue. All right. Now, so that's the basic setup, exploitation versus oppression. Now let me give you the more systematic exposition of the conditions that are present in a social relation that define it as exploitive rather than simple oppression. There are. What I'm going to do is lay out these three criteria, explain how it works to give you this contrast between non-exploitative oppression, or just oppression for short, and exploitation. And then I will discuss some of the ramifications of this concept. Okay, so there are three principles. These are laid out pretty clearly in the class counts chapter that was assigned. The first principle is called the inverse interdependent welfare principle. Inverse interdependent welfare principle. The material welfare of group A causally depends upon the deprivations of B. Or if you want a little sloganish way of saying it, the welfare of one depends upon the ill fare of others. Ill fare isn't a standard word. I kind of like it. I think it's a nice symmetrical term to welfare. Yeah?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
the material welfare of group A causally depends upon the deprivations of group B. The welfare of one depends upon the ill fare of others. That's the first of three criteria. The second criterion...
Sorry, just real quick, what was the name of that first principle?
The inverse interdependent welfare principle.
Thanks.
You know, of course, I mean, these are my names for these things. As I was sorting all this out and thinking really carefully about what's really going on here, I had to come up with expressions. None of this should be thought of as authoritative. This is the official name of this thesis or this criterion. It's just the way I try to label them so that we can keep the criteria in mind. Okay, the second principle is the resource exclusion principle. The second principle is a diagnosis of what's going on in the first principle. Why is it that there is this interdependency of welfare? And the second principle says, aha, underlying the causal relation in the inverse interdependent welfare principle, underlying that causal relation is the exclusion of group B from access to some important economic resource. Exclusion from access to a resource is what explains why it is that the welfare of one depends upon the ill fare of others. That's where there is this interdependence. It's because of some kind of resource exclusion mechanism. You can make this a bit stronger by saying that this exclusion must be in some meaningful sense unjust. So it's not entirely clear how important it is to add the notion that the exclusion in question is an unjust exclusion in order for it to count as an exclusion. This is a case where, you know, if you really worry about these things, you run into some special snags. So, for example, in a game of poker, where everybody is playing on equal terms, the loser is excluded from access to winnings, right? The loser in a game is excluded from the pot. And that is enforced by coercion, you know, pull out my six shooter, right? Nevertheless, it seems a little bit off the mark to say that the winners are oppressing the losers, because after all, they entered the game with full knowledge, they had full awareness of what the rules of the game were, nobody forced them to play the game was played under fair rules, so as long as there wasn't cheating, you know, if there's cheating, it's another matter, but as long as there wasn't cheating, normally we want to say the tough luck, you know, don't be a spoil sport, if you lose, you lose, so we want to exclude that, and so that's the sense in which you might want to say, the causal mechanism for the interdependent welfare thing is not just exclusion from access to a resource. It's an indictable exclusion. It's an exclusion that violates some principle of fairness. Now that, of course, opens up a big can of worms, of course, but life is filled with cans of worms. I think in the end, exploitation and oppression do have to involve at least a thin notion of injustice, unfairness, in order for it to really have its analytical bite. But for most contexts, that's not, I think, such a salient problem. That's the second principle. First principle, inverse interdependent welfare. Second principle, resource exclusion, which explains the first principle. The third principle is called the effort appropriation principle. And this is a principle which explains another consequence of exclusion, another specific consequence of exclusion that contributes to inverse interdependent welfare. The mechanism by which exclusion from resources generates inverse interdependence of welfare involves the appropriation of labor effort performed by group B for group A. This is verbatim, I think, from the chapter. So if you don't write it all down, it's there in the chapter. The effort appropriation principle says, okay, I'm gonna oversay it. The exclusion principle explains the inverse interdependent principle. The appropriation expert explains how the exclusion mechanism explains interdependent welfare. And the appropriation mechanism says this: the mechanism by which exclusion generates inverse interdependence of welfare, the mechanism, involves, and then here's the phrase, the appropriation of labor effort performed by group E, B, for group A. Labor appropriation is the mechanism by which, or a mechanism, by which exclusion generates inverse interdependent welfare. Now, exclusion can generate interdependent welfare without labor appropriation. That's the Native American case. Kick them off the land, we've excluded them, now we can use the land. What labor appropriation says, there's an additional mechanism by which exclusion can benefit me. I can get the excluded to work for me because they are now excluded. That's the labor appropriation principle. Non-exploited oppression satisfies the first two conditions, but not the third. Exploitation involves all three mechanisms. Now, why is this interesting? Why do we care about this distinction between simple oppression and non-exploitative oppression? Here is what I think is really in play here, and why it goes beyond just the moral indictment of these relations as somehow a violation of our notions of fairness or justice. And I would, you know, when I feel grandiose about this, I like to say this is the fundamental sociological insight about exploitation. I have a proclivity to want to, you know, say big thesis, underline it in your lecture notes, that in the outline I'll bring on Monday. This is in a big black box. I even kind of, so here's the fundamental sociological insight about exploitation. Exploitation is a form of oppression that gives power to the exploited. That's the key thing going on here. Exploitation is a form of oppression that actually gives power to the exploited, not just the exploiter, to the exploited. The exploited have levers of resistance and struggle absent from brute oppression. And the reason for this is that the exploiter needs the exploited. The exploiter is dependent upon the exploited. That's why the only good Indian is a dead Indian doesn't work for exploitation. You can't get rid of the exploited. And that means that pure repression of a brutal and destructive variety is not a very good strategy for maintaining an relation of exploitation. The exploited have power, have a source of power, because they're needed by their oppressor. They're needed. Their cooperation is needed. That's the key thing to really understand here. Their cooperation is needed. Yeah.
So I know you talked about the idea of revolution is probably not what we need to transform society. And is it this sort of principle here that you think is something that needs to be maximized to transform capitalism to something closer to socialism? Like, you know.
I think that's a separate set of problems. My skepticism about revolutionary rupture has to do with the costs to everybody involved of the rupture and why that, under conditions of complexity, makes it not a viable strategy.
Right, but therefore, if you have to find something else, I mean, if you have the idea that the people that are exploited actually have this power, that therefore they could, you know, capitalize on that power to say, okay, we need to do something to transform society in a way that doesn't rely on.
let's hold that idea. I think you're right that that is certainly part of it. The fact that there is a form of power that is permanently reproduced among the subordinated population because they are needed by the system. They're not external to the system. They're internal to it. They're interior to the very relations, which is also harming them. And their cooperation is required. That is certainly a key part of the lever which enables challenge to grow and to find ways of acting. So it is implicated. I don't think it's sufficient. I don't think the power generated interior to exploitation is sufficient to actually challenge the relation itself, but it is a way of challenging aspects of the conditions within those relations. Yeah.
I'm just making sure I'm getting this straight. The lord's serf relation was not a form of exploitation,
yeah,
per se, correct?
No, it is.
Oh, it is.
The lord's serf. When the lord just kicks the peasants off the land, then it's just oppression.
Okay.
When the lord dominates the peasantry and extracts part of the products of the peasantry, which is what feudalism is, the surplus is extracted coercively from the peasants, then it is exploitation. So there's a lot of ramifications of this, many aspects, even in slavery. So slavery is a brutal form of exploitation. But even in slavery, slaves had a capacity to resist. And they always did throughout slavery they resisted. And that acted as a constraint on the slave owner. The notion of the slow-witted, shuffling slave is those are resistance. Those are forms of resistance. Now that's not, there's no evidence whatsoever that the native intelligence and the capacity to think through problems was any different for slaves than anyone else. If anything, because of the adaptiveness and ingenuity required to survive under the conditions of the passage and all those things, one might expect that on average there was a certain kind of, adaptive capacity, intelligence that might have been selected. And I'm not going to go there, but, there's certainly no evidence that there was any diminished capacity, but they acted as if there was. And that is thought now by people who have thought through these issues as largely forms of resistance. It's very easy if you are a worker to do all sorts of things that act against the interests of your employers. Shirking is a chronic problem within class relations of production. Because we're not robots, because we have minds and wills and control our muscles and our activity, and because we always have the option of killing ourselves, right? I mean, that is always an option, to harm the interests of our oppressors, of our exploiters. That is always an option. Exploiters have to elicit some degree of cooperation. Or at least, if they try to elicit some degree of cooperation, they're likely to have a more productive form of exploitation than if they don't. But the fact that they need the collaboration of the exploited is a source of power for the exploited that purely oppressed don't have. One argument for mass incarceration of inner city African Americans in the United States today, one argument for why in this era that's the way we have dealt with the social disruptions and dislocations created by the particular patterns of racism intersecting post-industrialism, is that these are non-exploited oppressed groups, and a purely repressive response is appropriate because we don't need to elicit, the ruling class doesn't have to elicit their cooperation, it just has to neutralize their resistance. It's a sign, so to speak, of increasing civilization that extermination isn't the main solution to this problem. In the 19th century, for the equivalently marginalized group, that is the group that was excluded from access to the necessary means of production, genocide was the solution. With respect to Native Americans, the basic policy of the United States was genocidal rather than just repression. you know, putting them in stockades, as it were. In the late 19th century, when the reservation system was fully established, imprisonment on the reservation, so to speak, became an alternative to continued extermination. For the central city populations in the United States, repression is the main response to the dislocations and disruption caused by being excluded from access to the necessary means of production without being exploited. Okay, that's the idea I want to leave you with, is this notion of exploitation as a relation that generates harms and binds the lives of people together in a way that creates a power potential for the exploited. And we'll discuss some of the ramifications of that at the beginning of the next lecture. Thank you.